amid a cost of living crisis.
What we're going to be faced with is more of the same. I mean, clearly, Boris Johnson brought the office of Prime Minister into further disrepute. And I just think that what we have before us are a number of candidates who are all committed to imperialism, all committed to neoliberalism. They're all warmongers at the end of the day. So we're just kind of rearranging the deck chairs rather than actually making any significant difference. It's a case of sort of parliamentary parlour games, really, rather than any meaningful change.
Onlookers also fear that the race is full of candidates who have a track record of concerning policymaking.
Priti Patel in particular, very close to the Zionist entity, had unofficial visits when she was on a ministerial tour when Theresa May was the Prime Minister, and indeed got sacked as a consequence of that. It was Boris Johnson that brought her back in. But, you know, I mean, you just got to go through all the runners and riders. I mean, they've all got a very sort of checkered history, to say the least. At the end of the day, they're Conservatives, and, you know, they support a system which has actually impoverished millions of people in this country.
It's not yet clear who's going to come out on top in this race. However, one thing we do know for sure is that the next Prime Minister of the entire country is going to be decided by a minority group, paying Conservative Party members, much to the frustration of the majority electorate, who won't have a chance to say who the next Prime Minister will be. Robert Carter, London.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland. The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace. Just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic. Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but it didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much. Unless there's a snap election and then, say, like, Labour take over something, I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A fresh controversy is building in a Labour-held borough in East London as an embattled Muslim MP fights for her career. Elected as Britain's first hijab-wearing MP in 2019, Absana Begum's career started off well under the former leader Jeremy Corbyn. However, since Keir Starmer took over in 2020, things took an ugly turn, as local members in the safe Labour seat allegedly turned against her. Things became so bad that Begum was recently hospitalised and taken off work sick, following what she claims is a sustained campaign of misogynistic abuse. Despite this, a trigger ballot has now been launched, which aims to bar her from standing in the next election, a move condemned by her allies in Parliament. A former Muslim Labour member believes this may be part of a larger plot by party leadership to remove an MP they just don't like.
Absana Begum was previously subjected to a smear campaign where she was maliciously accused by a Labour council of supposedly committing housing fraud, and she was found not guilty when she was taken to court. And so this is actually the second attempt to destroy her political career. The people going after her are determined to stop anti-imperialists and practicing Muslims from being involved in public life, It isn't simply the case that Keir Starmer is failing to act. I believe that it's highly likely that Keir Starmer's office is directing this campaign of abuse, harassment and vilification against Apsana Begum. And this is part of a broader Islamophobic anti-socialist strategy to rid the Labour Party of anyone who previously supported Jeremy Corbyn and, frankly, to rid the party of practicing Muslims.
The Labour Party hasn't commented on the case so far. Press TV's attempts to reach Begum for further comment was also unsuccessful.
Starmer has been condemned by various Labour groups over conducting so-called purges of left-wing members who joined the party under Corbyn. Muslims as well feel very persecuted over their views on issues such as criticism of Israel and Palestine solidarity. The fact that Labour's first ever hijab-wearing MP also feels abused will likely deepen Muslim resentment in the party going forward. Robert Carter, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
On Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The war in Yemen has experienced a back-to-back truce, a badly needed one, given the humanitarian catastrophe in that country. So bad that the Red Cross has said that two-thirds of Yemenis are deprived of basic health care in unimaginable horror. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at this unimaginable horror, the U.S. complicity in this war. And even though the truce has been broken by the Saudis on more than one occasion, the reports that the U.S. may continue arms sales to the kingdom. Our guests joining us for this edition of The Spotlight are journalist and political analyst Yusuf Mowry, who joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us, the founder and editor of the independent news website, Multipolarista, Ben Norton, who joins us from Managua.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Ben Norton, let me first start with you. We are looking at the fact that you have a humanitarian situation unfolding in the degree that it is. That's no surprise. But given at this point, we're talking about how the Red Cross says unimaginable horror and that two-thirds of Yemeni people are deprived of basic health care, why hasn't there been any headway made in that arena, given the fact that we're looking at somewhat of a truce that's now been held back-to-back? We're looking at 4 months of it now, roughly.
Well, the answer is because it's in the strategic interests of the West to continue this war after more than 6 years now. We see that the Joe Biden administration is trying to improve its relations with Saudi Arabia and essentially telling Riyadh that it's going to be able to continue waging this war. Now, Joe Biden has repeatedly claimed he wants to end the war, but the reality is that it's in the West's continued interest to to support Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen and continue providing weapons and military support. And of course, if this were another country waging war on Yemen, like Russia, I think there would be an international outrage that was led by the West. But because it's the West that's backing this war on Yemen, and because the U.S. dominates media narratives and uses its political power to pressure other countries into silence, there's very little discussion of the fact that the people in Yemen are suffering from the worst humanitarian catastrophe on Earth. According to the United Nations, more than 370,000 Yemenis have died in this war, and that's a conservative estimate. And again, we have to ask why. Well, the answer is very clear. It's because the West is backing this war, and according to the West, anything that they want to do is supposedly justified.
Well, you're there, Yusuf Mary, in Sana'a, and when you take a look at the way that Yemenis speak about the West, as our guest there talks about, what West are they referring to that's basically unleashed through the Saudi-led coalition the horrors that is unfolding? Do they blame Saudi Arabia only? Do they blame the U.S.? Who are they blaming?
All of the above. That's who the Yemeni people are blaming. In fact, the international community, any country that is not speaking out against the Saudi coalition and U.S.'s continuous propensity to want to expand over, even if it means spilling the blood of tens of thousands of innocent people, any country that's not speaking out or is remaining silent to the genocide that's taking place in Yemen, that's what the Yemeni people are blaming, but primarily Saudi Arabia, and of course its U.S. allies, right? You have Saudi Arabia, who's been receiving billions and billions of dollars worth of military aid from the U.S., and the Yemeni people have experienced the reality of what those weapons, what the repercussion of Saudi Arabia having those weapons is going to be, and that's going to lead into the death of tens of thousands of more innocent Yemenis. So again, to answer your question, anybody who is not speaking out against Saudi Arabia, against the U.S. for its continuous atrocities on Yemen, they should be held accountable and they should be blamed, right? Also, the U.N., the U.N. Security Council, any U.N. entity that's, I was here last week and, we did an interview about the humanitarian crisis in the country. And, we're throwing numbers of tens of thousands of innocent people dying, thousands and thousands of innocent children starving to death because of the blockade. And you have, Amnesty International, you have the International Red Cross, the U.N. all speaking out and, basically proclaiming that they want to help alleviate the humanitarian crisis. But that's not the fact. That's not the reality, because all they really want to do is, use the case, the humanitarian case in Yemen, to justify, making money, to justify getting donations from their sponsors, their donors. If they really wanted to end the suffering in Yemen, they would call on Saudi Arabia, call on the UN to lift the strangling blockade. The people are starving on the ground because of the blockade. Basic necessities is not able to enter the country. That's not because the Yemeni people are poor. That's not because Yemen doesn't have enough natural resources to feed its people. It's simply because there's an insidious blockade being imposed by the U.S., by the U.N., and the international community, who are turning a blind eye to the atrocities that are taking place. When you look at what's happening in Ukraine, on the other hand, Amnesty International, the U.N., every country has condemned Russia, and they're claiming this is a Russian invasion, and Russia is killing innocent people, and Russia is doing this and is doing that. Not one of these entities is holding Saudi Arabia accountable. Not one of these nations or these entities is pointing the finger at the crown prince or the king of Saudi Arabia to tell him enough is enough.
Indeed. Well, when you look at it through that lens that our guests are from Sana'a just talked about there, Ben Orton, it shows UN complicity. And the only thing that comes to my mind is how Saudi Arabia, along with the U.S., are major contributors when it comes to the funding of the UN. We've known about how Saudi Arabia has actually been excused by the UN when it came to killing children in the war in Yemen and countless of other situations where, they made excuses for Saudi Arabia. And, of course, this sheds another light and another angle to this. Do you think that that is the reason, if you agree with our guest there from Sana'a, that perhaps even the UN is complicit, because this siege is not being lifted, and people in Yemen are still suffering.
Well, we do know that the pressure of funding has been a significant factor in the United Nations' inaction. In fact, the previous Secretary General Ban Ki-moon admitted that Saudi Arabia threatened to withdraw funding after the UN was going to put Saudi Arabia on its list of countries that violate the rights of children. So it's an objective fact that Saudi Arabia and the Western powers have used funding as blackmail to try to prevent the United Nations from taking action against this borderline genocidal war in Yemen. But we also know that inside the United Nations Security Council, which is the institution that has the most power, the U.S. has very frequently used its veto power to prevent any U.N. action. So I think it's very justified to criticize the U.N., but at the end of the day, the weaknesses of the U.N., I think, are reflections of Western imperialism and U.S. hegemony. The fact that the U.S. can use the U.N. to advance its geopolitical interests, and then when the U.N. tries to take actions that may in some way challenge U.S. interests, well, Washington can use its veto in the Security Council to block those resolutions. We've seen the United States many dozens of times has vetoed UN resolutions condemning apartheid Israel's illegal activities and occupation of Palestinian territories. So similarly, if the UN Security Council were to try to take action against Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen, it's very likely that the United States and also potentially Britain and France would use their veto power to prevent any UN action against Saudi Arabia. So once again, Riyadh can only carry out this war and kill hundreds of thousands of Yemenis because it has support from Western imperialist powers. And honestly, if the United States were to say tomorrow, we are ending our support for this war, I think the war would end within a few days. But the response from the White House is, of course, the opposite. Instead, Joe Biden is saying, well, we want to improve our relations with Saudi Arabia in order to continue our war on Russia as well. So in Washington, the solution to all of these problems is never less war. It's always more war.
Well, let me open up then this question, which I'm almost sure that maybe you have either read it, Yusuf Mari, or you've heard about it at this point. And that is the op-ed that Biden, the U.S. president, has written prior to his visit to the region, titled Why He's Going to Saudi Arabia. I mean, there in itself shows the level of, I don't want to say disillusion, because obviously either Biden wrote it himself or somebody wrote it for him. But it really is a far stretch from the reality. And I begin with this, Yusuf Mari, where Biden says, the war in Yemen was escalating, creating one of the world's worst humanitarian crises with no political process. In Yemen, I named an envoy and engaged with leaders across the region, including the King of Saudi Arabia, to lay the foundation for a truce. What do you think when the U.S. president is saying that?
Well, he's obviously pushing the U.S.'s political agenda, and he's going to say whatever he's going to say to push that agenda. I mean, you have a president who's ignoring the death and the genocide of tens of thousands of innocent people in order to pursue and to continue the Western hegemonic international structure, right? And that's been the case. Biden, he's scheduled to visit Saudi Arabia in the next couple of days. And the reason why he's doing that is, the U.S. has a propensity to beef up its allies with military weapons in order to continue Western expansion and in order to continue the U.S.'s interest dominance over the region. But what's interesting about this visit, this visit actually, is that the U.S. and Israel, they're actually laying the groundwork for a new security alliance to be established between the U.S., between Israel, and most of the Arab states, most of the Saudi-backed coalition. And the purpose of this visit is they want to create or connect military technology to combat Yemen. They're actually building a network of radars, detectors, weapon interceptors, and they want to use this military technology, unprecedented military technology, to attack Yemen on demand. And not only attack Yemen, but they also want to counter any missile attacks by the Sana'a government towards Saudi Arabia or toward any of the countries that are waging this aggression on Yemen. And what's even more interesting is that the U.S. and the Israeli entity, they're actually using Yemeni islands. They're using Yemeni territory to build these military bases, to build these detectors, to build these sophisticated state-of-the-art radars. They're using the island of Socotra. They're using the island of Meitun. And this is all Yemeni land that's being used to point its weapons and to point its missiles towards the Yemeni people. So this is an unprecedented event where you have a, you know, just think of NATO joining forces with the Arab coalition being led by the Israeli entity and the and U.S. supreme military technology all joining forces to wage war on Yemen. This is, you know, this is not propaganda. This is actually happening as we speak. So as we speak, in spite of the humanitarian crisis that's taking place on the ground, you have more military activity in preparation to wage an all-out war on Yemen. And from the looks of it, it's going to happen in the near future.
Mm-hmm. We're going to discuss that a little bit more. I need to open this op-ed more because it's really incredible, Ben Norton, when you think about it. Another very controversial statement coming out of it, in a sense, is how the U.S. president says, after a year of our persistent diplomacy, this truce is now in place. News just came out today, exclusively, of course. Internal U.S. discussions on Saudi arms at early stage, decision likely to depend on Saudi efforts to end the war. So you have the U.S. announcing potential arms sales. Biden did sell arms back in November of 2021 to the tune of between $650 to $750 million. So how do you evaluate the way that Biden is presenting himself in this op-ed with this last viewpoint that I just presented?
Well, it's more of the same. Joe Biden claimed repeatedly during his presidential campaign that he would end the war in Yemen. And when he came in January of 2021, then in February, a few weeks after entering office, he claimed that he had reached a new agreement with Saudi Arabia and he was ending support for all offensive operations. Now, he claimed that the U.S. was continuing support for Saudi defensive operations. But of course, the very nature of the Saudi war is an aggressive war. It is a war that was launched in March 2015, bombing Saudi Arabia's southern neighbor, Yemen. And Saudi Arabia, with the support of the U.S., Britain, and France, has carried out tens of thousands of airstrikes. How can an airstrike be defensive? It's not defensive. So we see that from the very beginning, the Biden administration has been the master of trying to use this language that sounds like he's ending the war, that sounds like he's pursuing peace and diplomacy, but all he's really doing is redefining what the U.S. is doing in supporting Saudi Arabia and its war in Yemen, and then saying that he made progress. And similarly now, he says that he's going to pressure Saudi Arabia to end the war in Yemen and then going to start selling offensive weapons. Are we really supposed to believe that if Saudi Arabia says, oh, we're ending the war in Yemen, but we buy all of these weapons from the U.S., are we really supposed to believe that Saudi Arabia is not going to use those weapons? Then why is it buying those weapons? It's clearly buying those weapons with the intent to use them. And maybe Saudi Arabia says, okay, we have officially ended operations, and then it unofficially continues waging this war. And we also have to be clear, when Biden says that Saudi Arabia is going to engage in diplomacy, does that mean that it's going to recognize the de facto government in Yemen that governs the majority of where the population of Yemen lives, which is the Sana'a government? Is Saudi Arabia ever going to recognize that government? And of course, the answer is very unlikely. Saudi Arabia is still going to recognize the puppet regime, which was unelected in the south, as the illegitimate government of Yemen. So that's not a diplomatic solution. That's just kicking the problem under the rug and pretending like it no longer exists.
Okay, let's break this down with the information you gave us, Yusuf Mowry. We're looking at the Socotra Island, where it is reported that the UAE is setting up a military base with Israeli cooperation and perhaps to have Israeli special operatives operating there along with the UAE. What type of purpose does that serve, and what are they doing to execute whatever military purposes they believe it serves them? If you can please explain that to us.
Well, they basically, so here's how it works in Yemen, right? With what's been, you know, has been empirically proven. The U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, they've come to the realization that they will not win the war inside of Yemen. In other words, they understand that they will not be able to topple, they will not be able to dethrone the Sana'a government from power because, one, the Sana'a government has a large portion of support from the Yemeni people, and they've managed to win the hearts and minds of the majority of the Yemeni people. They've tried over the past 7 years to overthrow, to dethrone the Sana'a government, and they failed miserably across the board to achieve this goal. So now, plan B, if you will, they will no longer try to take over the capital Sana'a. What they're going to do instead, actually, they're going to try to turn Yemen into another Gaza, whereby Yemen as a nation will be imprisoned. It will be besieged and surrounded with military bases to wage attack on demand anytime that they feel the need to do so. So just because they can't overthrow the government and just because they can't win the hearts and the minds of the Yemeni people, they're resorting to Plan B, which calls for the engulfing the entire nation with military bases and waging attacks anytime the Yemeni government, the Sana'a government, attempts to resuscitate the economy, anytime the Yemeni government attempts to rebuild its military and public institutions. They're basically hell-bent on keeping Yemen in the worst humanitarian crisis until they get the regime change that they want. So unless the U.S. and Israel and Saudi Arabia get the regime change that they so desperately want, they're going to keep the Yemeni people starving to death. They're going to keep this strangling blockade imposed on the country. They're going to continue their airstrikes. They're going to continue their military offensive from all four corners of Yemen. And this is what the Socotra Island is being used for. This is what the island of Ma'un is being used for. This is what the northwest south is being used for in Yemen. Any place in Yemen, any area that's under the occupation of Saudi Arabia and its mercenaries is going to be used to continue waging this Saudi war on Yemen. And to answer your question, so this is what the plan is right now. Since they can't take over Yemen, since they can't get the regime change that they want, they're basically hell-bent on turning Yemen into another Gaza. They basically want it to be a country without a thriving economy. They basically want Yemen to be without a military, and they want the country to be divided and in a state of chaos and instability.
When you want to break down the amount of incentive each entity has in this game, Ben Norton, I'm sorry, I shouldn't use the word game, in this process, we're looking at the United States, Saudi Arabia, obviously, and we're also looking, obviously, in the increasing role that Israel plays. It appears that the U.S. may be outnumbered when it comes to an incentive to have the scenario that our guest from Sana'a says to be executed, because even if Saudi Arabia, even if the U.S. does not want to pursue this war, Israel is pushing for that scenario that our guest from Sana'a is saying. I'm sure that you have Saudi Arabia that perhaps maybe even laying out that as a condition in order for the situation or the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. to improve, and arms sales being one of those prerequisites of Saudi Arabia. Is that a possibility?
Well, I think so, but the reality is that for the United States, they, speaking frankly, unfortunately, the United States government does not care about the people of Yemen. It never has. It was waging a drone war that killed many Yemeni civilians. The Trump administration carried out raids that killed Yemeni children. The U.S. government sees Yemen as a chip in a game. I mean, you use the term game. Unfortunately, that's the way these policymakers in Washington see the world. They see countries not as countries representing sovereign people of flesh and blood, they see the countries as potential allies or enemies. And George W. Bush famously said that the perspective of the U.S. government is you're either with us or you're against us. And the U.S. government is trying to force every country around the world to join its alliance in a new Cold War that it's waging on both China and Russia. And of course, Iran is a strategic partner of both China and Russia. And that further incentivizes the U.S. and apartheid Israel to work together to pressure all countries in West Asia to take aggressive actions against Iran, to try to isolate Iran and also, of course, isolate China and Russia. So unfortunately, in terms of what U.S. interests are, The U.S. has no interest whatsoever in protecting the Yemeni people. The Joe Biden administration may claim for public relations purposes and you know, its public speeches that it cares about human rights. But I'm sure that when Biden sits down with Mohammed bin Salman, he's going to say very clearly, look, we're against Iran, we're against China, we're against Russia. You just have to do something publicly to get all of these people criticizing me off of my back. He's going to tell MBS that you should say that you formally ended the war, and we're going to continue as you informally continue this war. And I think the guest from Sana'a is correct that the U.S. strategy is to turn Yemen into a new Gaza and to try to get everyone around the world to just forget about it. Okay. And allow Saudi Arabia to continue occupying it, blockading it, and continuing a war, but a quiet war, so the White House doesn't have to deal with public criticism.
Thank you. Yusuf Mari from Sana'a, journalist and political analyst, thank you. Founder and editor of the independent news website Multipolarista, Ben Norton from Managua. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tawe and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today we complete our explanation of Surah Waqia, that is, the imminent hour or the inevitable event to occur at the end of time. As we have already explained to you, it refers to the day of resurrection, followed by the final judgment, which the disbelievers deny in fear of the sorting out of good and evil, since people on that day will be divided into three classes. Those brought near to the divine threshold for having reached the highest degree of faith, those on the right hand, or ordinary believers who made mistakes but turned in repentance to Allah and thereafter lived a pious life, and those on the left hand, that is, the disbelievers who denied God's message and the prophets, lived in sins and died in the state of disbelief. Ample proof is given in this surah of the infinite power of the Almighty Creator and consequently His ability to bring about the resurrection. If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last week, we said the evolutionary process should make any rational person realize the power of God Almighty to raise the dead to life, especially in view of the fact that the Noble Quran presents the most logical arguments by arguing readers to reflect on the wonders of the world of creation, as well as upon their own selves to attain faith and eventually the bliss of paradise, instead of committing wrongs and plunging into the fires of hell. We also pointed out to the elixir of life, that is water, which pours down from the clouds to make rivers flow and vegetation to grow, saying that the very power that makes seeds in the soil sprout and become plants is able to raise to life the dead humans on the day of resurrection. In other words, whether it is the development of agriculture or the process of procreation, we human beings might be the instruments of action, but it is the will of God that provides us with a rich variety of crops and the birth of babies and their development into perfect persons blessed with manifold talents. All these ought to inspire us to celebrate the glory of the all-wise Creator and express gratitude to Him instead of being thankless and turning into disbelievers and sinners. Listen to ayahs 75, 76, 77, 78, 79, 80, 81, and 82 of Surah Waqia.
فلا أقسم بمواقع النجوم وإنه لقسم لو تعلمون عظيم إنه لقرآن كريم في كتاب مكنود لا يمسه إلا المطهرون تنزيل من رب العالمين أفبهذا الحديث أنتم مدهنون وتجعلون رزقكم أنكم تكذبون
ناي I swear by the orbit of the stars, and indeed it is a great oath, should you know. This is indeed a Qur'an, the most honorable. In a guarded book, the preserved tablet, no one touches it except the pure ones. A revelation gradually sent down from the Lord of all the worlds. What? Do you take lightly this discourse?
and make your denial of it your vocation or livelihood? These ayahs ascertain the flawless veracity of the Noble Quran, which is indeed an eternal miracle for the guidance of all mankind, granted by the Almighty Creator to his last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Ayah 76 is thus a divine oath by emphasis on the places and orbits of the stars, which are billions or more in number, and follow their fixed courses with precision as per the law of gravity without any collision. This makes the oath on the honor, the status of the Quran far more significant. A scientist and any rational person should affirm based on the discoveries of more and more galaxies that remarkably function in an orderly manner, as is evident by our own solar system and its planets, including our wonderful Earth. Without the least doubt, this is a great oath, making an extraordinary announcement that the Quran, to use the Arabic word in the ayah, Karim, or the most honorable, for the bounties it opens for the believers in various paths. Therefore, what has been revealed to the Prophet for the guidance of humanity is preserved in a well-guarded tablet, which means the Noble Quran ought to be touched in the state of cleanliness after due ablution, in order to properly understand its dynamic contents for leading a sound and healthy life away from sins and with enthusiasm for expanding the vistas of knowledge, while only the thoroughly purified ones know its esoteric meanings for further unraveling of the wonders of creation. Ayah 81, pointing to the revelation of the Noble Quran to the Prophet by the Creator of the universe, poses the question in the next ayah on the denial of this manifest truth by the disbelievers and how these deviated persons make a living by continuing to deny facts and realities in order to mislead the ignorant people. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, divine oath on the wonders of creation is very significant and implies the highly honored status of the Noble Quran, which the Almighty Creator has revealed for the guidance of all mankind by urging them to reflect on its rational and dynamic contents. Number two, the flawless veracity of the Noble Quran is free of any vain discourse or interpolation, and thus, in order to strengthen faith and benefit from its bezels of wisdom, it should be touched in the state of cleanliness and after due ablution. Number three, it is only the Prophet and his purified progeny, Quran, who know the inner meaning of the ayahs of the Noble Quran, and thus further open the vistas of knowledge for the seekers of truth. And number four, negligence, trivialization, and denial of the manifest truth of the Noble Quran results from disbelief in the day of resurrection. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 83, 84, 85, 86, and 87 of the same surah.
فَلَوْلَا إِذَا بَلَغَتِ الْحُلْقُومَ وَأَنْتُمْ حِينَئِذٍ تَنْظُرُونَ وَنَحْنُ أَقْرَبُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْكُمْ وَلَكِنْ لَا تُبْصِرُونَ فلولا إن كنتم غير مدينين ترجعونها إن كنتم صادقين.
So when it, the soul leaving the body, reaches the throat of the dying person, while you are looking on, and we are nearer to him than you are, though you do not perceive. Then why do you not, if you are not subject to the divine dispensation, restore it? Should you be truthful? These ayahs hint at God's power of resurrection by pointing to the last moments of a person's life when none can avert death, which is decreed by the Almighty Creator, who is nearer to every one of us than our own selves. Although most do not realize this fact, owing to their fickle faith or lack of faith. The intention here is to awaken the conscience of the helpless onlookers who are also destined to meet the same fate. Despite modern sophisticated technical and medical equipment, which cannot compensate human weakness, thereby exposing the liars and deniers who doubt resurrection and the Day of Judgment. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the power that gave life and decreed death can resurrect the dead from rotten and powdered bones for the final judgment. And number two, no one, including modern scientific technology, have the power to avert death, let alone restoring the death to life. Now, in conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which also marks completion of Surah Waqia, we present you ayahs 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, 93, 94, 95, and 96. فَأَمَّا إِن كَانَ مِنَ الْمُقَرَّبِينَ فروح وريحان وجنة نعيم وأما إن كان من أصحاب اليمين فسلام لك من أصحاب اليمين وأما إن كان من المكذبين الضالين فنزل من حميم وتصلية جحيم إن هذا لهو حق اليقين فسبح باسم ربك العظيم. Then, if he be of those brought near to the divine threshold, then ease, abundance, and a garden of bliss. And if he be of the people of the right hand, then greeting to you from the people of the right hand. But if he be of the deniers, the astray ones, then a treat of boiling water, an entry into hell. Indeed, this is the certain truth. So celebrate the name of your Lord, the All Supreme. These ayahs sum up the points discussed in the beginning of the surah, which classifies people into three categories on Resurrection Day on the basis of differing human dispositions at the time of death. Thus, those destined to be near the divine threshold pass away with utmost serenity, peace of mind, and happiness for the abundant bliss of paradise. Those on the right hand also attain felicity and the company of the virtuous in heaven, for having died with faith after repentance in the divine court and seeking of forgiveness from the all-merciful Lord. And for the disbelievers, the deniers of truth, and the unrepentant sinners, death opens up for them the gates of horrible punishment, with boiling water and fall into the fires of hell. This is indeed the undeniable truth, and we should therefore celebrate the name of the Lord Most High. These ayahs teach us that, number one, people are generally scared of death, but for those who are firm of faith and have abstained from sins, or those who have repented of their misdeeds and become righteous, death brings for them great bounties, including the bliss of paradise. And number two, as for the disbelievers and unrepentant sinners, the moment the soul leaves the physical body, the never-ending torment begins.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up.